This episode of Spawned is brought to you by Care.com. It's the easy and reliable way to find care for everyone in your family when and where you need it. With access to 8.6 million caregivers across 16 countries, you're sure to find the local caregivers you need, whether it's a nanny, sitter, a housekeeper, senior care, dog walker, or more. Getting started is so easy. Just sign up for free as a basic member at care.com/coolmompics. Or just for Spawned listeners, save 30% off a Care.com premium membership. Just go to care.com/coolmompics when you subscribe and you'll get 30% off. Hello and welcome to Spawned, a common sense and hopefully fun discussion on parenting and parenting culture. I'm Liz Gumpener and I'm missing my other half, Kristen Chase. We're the co-founders of CoolMompics.com, but I'm flying solo today since Kristen is out of town. And I have to say, I would normally be incredibly lonely, except for the fact that I have the most fabulous guest today, Lauren Smith Brody, who is hilarious, smart, and the very helpful author of The Fifth Trimester, The Working Mom's Guide to Style, Sanity, and Big Success After Baby. So, obviously, on today's Spawned, we're going to be talking about essential tips for getting back to work and surviving as a new mom. And, of course, we'll end with our cool picks of the week. So, welcome, Lauren.
Hi. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I'm so glad that we can finally chat. I feel like we've been kind of tiptoeing around the same circles for years in this parenting space.
I know. When you look at our Facebook pages, it's like 52 people in common. And yes.
And all the best people.
Yes, definitely.
So, for our listeners who don't know Lauren, and you should, here's just a little bit more about her. Lauren, you're the founder of the Fifth Trimester Movement, which helps parents and businesses work together to create a more family-friendly workplace culture. So yay for that. You're a longtime leader in the women's magazine industry. You were the executive editor of Glamour Magazine, which we've all heard of. And she ran the editorial staff and produced the magazine's annual Women of the Year Award. Speaking of people we've already heard of, you honored luminaries like Maya Angelou, Hillary Clinton. So, you know, no one big or anything like that. And now you're the author of the Fifth Trimester book, which is like number one in a zillion different categories on Amazon right now. So congrats on that.
Thank you. Thank you. I like to say I'm in my own 27th trimester right now, because as you can tell from that intro, I am in a new phase of my career. And this is all kind of a new beginning and a transition for me too. So I relate to a lot of what these new moms were saying, even though my kids are 5 and 8 now.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I always say I'm in my 27th trimester, but that usually relates to like my jean size. So I'm excited to talk about it in terms of work, because I also worked in all different ways after having a baby. I worked in an office, I worked from home, I ran my own business, I kind of tried all of it. So I'm so glad you're here to help people like me get through what can be a really tough time. So first, I just want to start by saying, and I'm not kidding, this is the book I wish I had written. Kristen and I were just talking about this morning.
Oh, thank
you.
I'm
looking at the Fifth Trimester. I wish I could have read the whole book all at once. I've gone through a lot of it, and it's so good. And even in the book jacket, when it says it's an honest, funny, judgmental-free tips, to-do lists,
yes,
take charge strategies. And I'm like, she's me, Lauren, you're me.
Oh, well, I'm super honored, because I think you're great. yeah, the no judgment part was really, really important to me. I wanted this book to be able to be helpful for the broadest range of women out there in all kinds of jobs, all kinds of financial circumstances, all different approaches to motherhood and career, and for there to be something in here that helps everyone feel just more solid through this transition.
And I'm so glad to hear that, because we look at a lot of working mom books and they tend to be very focused on urban, white collar, upper middle class working moms. There's a certain, let's just say, I don't know, daughter of a certain big US politician right now who just came out with a book about working moms. Definitely a very small subset of working moms. So how do you think the book applies in such a broad way? Because I know our listeners have all different circumstances when it comes to work.
Well, this was actually part of what was an education for me as I researched it. And it was really important that this book not just be a memoir about my own experience. Just to give you a little bit of background on sort of how I pitched the idea initially when I was first coming up with it. As you said, I'd worked at Glamour Magazine at Condé Nast. And while I had had personally a really, really hard transition, both to motherhood and to working motherhood, much harder than I had anticipated, I just knew that I couldn't be that girl sitting in the tower in Times Square talking about how hard my life was. And so I'd actually very purposefully did a huge survey. I initially wanted it to be just 100 people answering it sort of from all over the country if I could, to make sure that I was approaching every bit of this that needed to be helped and answered. And very quickly, because I learned also that moms love helping other moms,
yes.
The survey spread. So I had wrote it was about a 50 question survey. It was pretty long. It took about 15 or 20 minutes to take it.
Well, you worked at Glamour. You know, yes. Women like taking surveys.
Exactly. And it's funny, women love taking surveys. I learned that show them how far they've come too. So it spread like wildfire. People put it on their Facebook groups. And because of the awesome software that I just sort of stumbled upon, I was actually able to see the map of where everyone took it. Mm. And I gathered enough personal information to have a sense of what these women's jobs were and their own circumstances. And there were women from all 50 states, including Puerto Rico, who were answering it. And I had answers from women who were at kind of every level of career and ambition. You know, there were people who were quite young and just starting out. There were people who were, you know, coming to motherhood later in life, single moms, adoptive moms, hourly wage workers, as well as CEOs. So I realized very quickly that I just had this incredible resource that wasn't just going to help other people, but was actually going to help educate me as I did my own research.
I think that's amazing. Also, because, you know, in New York, we can be in a little bit of a bubble.
Yeah,
for sure. You grew up kind of all over the country. So I bet that that gave you a certain level of perspective about kind of different lifestyles, and that life is not New York City for a lot of people.
Yeah, my cousins are all in Ohio. I grew up mostly in Atlanta and Texas. So I've got, at least I hope, a little bit of perspective beyond the bubble.
So one of the first things I noticed about the book when you first open it is you open with a Jim Henson quote. So right away, I'm like, I love this. And it said, "Kids don't remember what you try to teach them. They remember what you are." So can you talk to me about that? Because I don't think you mean that all moms should work, that what you are is defined by your job. But tell me what you were thinking when you saw that quote.
No, what I was really thinking is that kids see how satisfied you are in your life, whatever choices you've made. And sadly, because of sort of where the United States ranks in terms of the benefits and the care it offers to new parents, most parents don't have as many choices as they'd like to have.
Yeah.
But I wanted to, with this book, hopefully give women more of a sense of agency, no matter what their circumstances are, so that they can ask for what they need in as many circumstances as possible and become, if not necessarily defined by their career, because I think actually being at home is one of the hardest things that you can do, at least have your child know that my mom was ambitious in what she did in life, and my mom loved who she was. Who she is. Hopefully you're still alive.
You know, one of the biggest questions that we ask ourselves if we jump right into getting back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is for everybody, not just working parents, but you talk about mommy guilt. And I'm so glad, because we talk about that a lot on Spawned. I write about it a lot on Cool Mom Picks. But I think whether you're working at home, working out of the house full time, starting a business, there is just mommy guilt in anything that you do.
Yes.
So is it really possible to get over it?
Well, I think it's about redefining it. And there's a number of spots in the book where I sort of take what has become a standard idea of what we think of motherhood and try to turn it on its head a little bit and at least help you have agency in how you think about it. And one of those areas is guilt, because I really, really feel like we need to be in a post-mommy guilt world.
Yay.
Yeah, amen. Really. So I mean, and that sounds like a lofty goal, except when you actually break it down. So I surveyed, as you said, I think over 700 women, but then I did deeper interviews with another additional 106. And there was not a single interview in which a woman did not use the word guilt. Every single person talked about guilt.
Really? With 700 women?
Well, so the deeper interviews were the 106. So 106 women all talked about guilt.
But that's still amazing.
Yeah. And so, but what I was fascinated by is that I transcribed all these interviews and I realized that this word guilt kept popping up, but it meant completely different things to different people.
Mm-hmm.
So some people talked about feeling guilty about leaving their baby in a caregiver's arms who maybe they just didn't trust was doing as good a job as they would do themselves. That was one kind of guilt. Other women talked about feeling guilty for actually quite enjoying being back at work, you know, and having a cup of hot coffee without a baby on them, worrying that they're going to spill it. And so there were just all these different definitions of guilt. And I realized that women were using this term guilt as a sort of default. But if you actually talk about what the real feeling is, that helps you deal with it. Is it regret? Is it conflict? Is it elation at being able to have that cup of coffee? That's okay too.
Mm.
But we're not doing ourselves any kind of service by calling it mommy guilt. You never hear about anybody talking about daddy guilt, although I would welcome that conversation. But it felt to me like, do you remember in math class how you could scratch out the common denominator?
Yeah.
It felt like the common denominator that we all just needed to scratch out in order to be able to deal with whatever the real issue is.
Do you think that we talk about mommy guilt as a way of being self-deprecating? Because one thing I've found just from blogging and being in the online space with moms for 10 years is that one thing that helps us connect to each other is by admitting we're imperfect or we're not so great or we're not as together as you think we are, despite our Pinterest feeds or our Instagram shots of our family. Like, do you think talking about mommy guilt is kind of a way to connect over our imperfections? Or do you think people really genuinely feel guilt?
I think it's the former, but I think there are so many other better things to bond over with new moms. I mean, so one thing I learned in my own experience, but actually didn't really think about until I heard it again and again in my interviews, was all these women who talked about the friendships that they made when they had these new little babies that were predicated on nothing but the fact that they had these new little babies. So these are women who were like, on maternity leave, however short or long that may have been for them, who met up with other moms who may have had a baby just the same age. And their careers were wildly different. Maybe some of them were stay-at-home moms versus work-out-of-the-home moms. All of their circumstances were different except for that baby, and that baby was all it took to bond them. So what was so interesting is that these women talked about how it was very world-expanding for them, both in terms of kind of their appreciation for moms who had made different choices than they had themselves, but also among the working moms to meet other mothers in other fields. Because I think that you start to think, at least in my experience, I definitely started to think that, everything that happened in publishing in terms of benefits was just what was normal. But then I would meet people who worked in other fields, and their sense of what was normal was different. And it really emboldened me, and the women I interviewed told me about how it emboldened them to realize that there were other options and other approaches that kind of made it more okay to ask for changes.
I love that you brought that up because I found that that's in part one of the best things about the internet for moms,
Yes, it's
is
so
that it
true.
helps us find our village in ways that we never could before. And we've talked about this on Spawned, but it's how Kristen and I met. We both had little kids. We had personal blogs, and she commented on my blog, and I commented on her blog, and we became blog friends. And 3 months later, we like started a business together. And we didn't even meet in person until we had started Cool Mom Picks like 3 or 4 months earlier.
Oh, wow.
And we keep saying, like, how else would we have met each other? She at the time was a military wife living on a base in Mississippi. She was like a former music therapist and textbook author. And I was like the advertising exec going back and forth between New York and LA. And we keep saying, like, if it weren't for the internet, how else would we have met? So even though we bonded over, hey, we both have little kids, slowly we realized like we have so much in common and we looked at different ways of working. And the other women in our circle who we started to meet online who became good friends, like, it just really opened my eyes to other experiences, as you're saying. And a lot of these people 10 years later really are my dearest friends. And I'm so grateful for the internet in that sense. Do you hear that from, the people that you talk to, that online is, the online communities are helpful when you're going back to work?
Definitely, definitely. I also think that what you're describing makes you a better mother because your child is not going to necessarily be made exactly in your image. And to understand, sort of different approaches to life and everything, this sounds so cheesy, but it makes you more sensitive to a child who may not be just exactly like you and always think just like you. But so yeah, the internet. So women talked definitely about how they just needed that sense of community no matter where they could find it. And this is a time in life, especially when you're just going back to work, when you don't really necessarily have time for like a weekly girl date, a monthly girl date. You might find it online. So one thing that women described to me that I found really helpful and I've started doing myself is they talked about their need to use their commute more effectively, which sounds so lame. Like, first of all, commutes mean different things to different people. Some people commute in a car, some people commute by dropping their kids at school and coming back to home and then getting started on their work in their home office. But they described their commute as being 50% more stressful after having a baby than it had been before.
I completely can agree with that. I've been there.
That was, I mean, I was on the subway, like sweating, desperate to get home because I knew that if I got home 7 minutes late, our babysitter would dip into the frozen milk supply. And I really didn't want her to. But I also didn't want my baby home, crying, waiting for me. But so I talked to a bunch of mental health experts as well as moms who shared all kinds of interesting ways to use your commute for, this is such a trendy phrase, but it's good for self-care. And one thing that a lot of women described is they said that that was really their found time to be in touch with their friends, whether it was a group text, whether it was checking Facebook, whatever it was that just gave them that instant burst of, I belong to this community that really helped them with the transition out of work mode and back into home mode, feeling like they had taken a breath.
You know what? I don't care if it's cliche. I love that you spend a lot of time in your book talking about a self-care plan at work, because we as moms tend to put ourselves last.
Yeah.
We just do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what are other things that you think women can do, you know, as new moms to take care of themselves so that they don't run out of energy and have nothing left for themselves?
Well, I think it's really important that the things that you actually take the time to do really sink in meaningfully and that you see that you've taken time for yourself. So this is a little bit sad, but when I talked about sort of the redefinition of guilt, I also think that we need to redefine me time. So we have this sort of like cartoon notion that me time is your face in one of those cushy ring things that you put it in when you have a massage. Like,
right.
That is not necessarily me time that a new mom, not many new moms are going to have, at least not right when they're going back to work. So I think it's really important, although it's a little sad, it is important to redefine what gives you pleasure in life. And me time is not necessarily just going to be time spent alone. It can be time spent just doing something that gives you pleasure. If it is, you know, if you love buying new onesies for your baby, but that's also a chore on your list, but you can, you know, put your baby in a stroller, get in the car on a sunny day and go run that errand and take actual pleasure in that errand, because it is time with your baby and it is time doing something that you enjoy, even if it is technically for somebody else who's not you. But recognize that that can help at least through the transition, because on the other side of the fifth trimester, you are actually going to have to find time that is really just for yourself.
You know, it's interesting because when I went back to working full time at an office for a period, for me, the me time was lunch.
Yeah.
It was an expense, but like I had a thing about I have to go out for lunch every day. And I mean, sit out in a restaurant, but I was lucky enough to work in the city across from Chelsea Market. And just to have like 15 minutes by myself to walk across the street and browse and look at all the cool goodies and bring myself like something really nice back to the office or sit outside if it was nice for a few minutes. To me, that was really valuable, even if it was only 15 minutes. And I took the time to treasure that in a way that I think the non-parents at work didn't, you know, for them, it's just like social time. For me, it was me time.
Right. And it's you time. And the ongoing payoff of it is that not only did you take the time, but you know that you took the time. You actually, like, you must have your stuff together enough if you were able to actually do that for yourself. And that, I think, is really confidence building. I remember, so lunch was actually a huge letdown for me because letdown, that's a good word, because I was pumping. And so in order to maintain my supplies, just the way my boobs worked, I had to pump 3 times a day at work. And so one of those times was at lunchtime. And I remember just sort of the sad irony of like sandwich in, milk out, you know, but it took a while to realize that it was still okay for me to go take that 10 or 15 minute walk and call it my lunch, even if I had just taken a half an hour, 45 minutes to sit and pump. And obviously that is not a circumstance that works in every field, you know, by any means.
Right.
But one thing that helped me sort of negotiate that in my mind and then be kind of open about it with my colleagues was that I was able to make my pumping time work time. Not everybody is able to do that. You know, some people kind of really need to be in the zen of I'm thinking about my baby's sweet face and that's how I'm going to get the most milk. After a couple weeks, I found that I could actually use it as solid, uninterrupted work time. Actually, I was occasionally interrupted and walked in on, but I'm happy to discuss it. But for the most part, I was able to kind of save up some emails or to schedule a call. And actually, scheduling a call was very helpful because it meant that I had to be at my desk pumping by that time and I wouldn't be late to pump. But eventually I did learn to also take that 15 minute walk.
I think that's good because, you know, I was thinking that I was not one of those women who loved being pregnant.
Me either.
So yeah, I felt like an incubator and I was on partial bed rest. So I wasn't allowed to work out. I wasn't even supposed to walk my dog around the block. Like it really was brutal, like on me emotionally. And believe me, I'm no like exercise queen.
No, but in your but, poor like, dog too.
Exactly. And so to feel like the incubator for 9 months and then go back to work eventually and feel like, okay, my lunch hour has to be taken up with pumping. It's like everything starts to feel like an obligation to the baby.
Yes.
So I really like that you talk about like finding those little moments of self-care that's really just about you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
The other thing that you talked about that I really stood out to me in the book that I loved, well, there were many things, but here's one. So you talked about making motherhood part of your identity at work. And I'm so glad you did, because this is one of the things that saved me, is that the president of the ad agency, she was a mom too, with a kid about the same age as mine. And we talked about it a lot. And it just made life so much easier for me, knowing I didn't have to hide it. And then if I ever needed to run into her room and shut the door and be like, ah, multitasking, that she would get it and appreciate it. And she acknowledged me as a mom. And I couldn't do that in every situation. Like, certainly there's some clients who just don't want to hear it. They just want to think you're working 100% for them, that you're not thinking about anything besides work. So when you talk about making motherhood part of your identity at work, like, what does that mean? Who can anyone do that? Can everyone do that?
So, to be totally honest, not everyone can do it. However, I really feel, and it's a major tenet of what I'm trying to communicate in the book, that to whatever degree you can, if you can just go one step beyond what makes you really comfortable to stretch a little bit, like imagine what would happen if we all did that. Imagine just the giant sea change that would happen if we all just stretched a little bit to make ourselves show a little bit more of our motherhood than possible. Because I really truly believe that if you can broadcast when you're coming back to work the things that are hard, if people know that you actually aren't sleeping very well, if people know that you feel a little bit on edge, first of all, they will be more empathetic and understanding. But secondly, they will see that not only are you getting your job done, but you're getting it done under these circumstances. And how amazing is that?
You know what that made me think of? Do you know who does this really well? Brides-to-be.
Oh
There
my gosh.
isn't a single woman I've ever worked with
God,
that
so
wasn't
true.
planning a wedding that every single person didn't know about it, didn't see her 18
Right.
color-coded folders with like all her magazine pull-outs in it. Like, women who are planning a wedding get love and affection and attention and time off and, respect. And I was just thinking, maybe we need to kind of adopt that as moms and
Totally.
take as much pride in it.
Because you know what? I think planning a wedding is such a like a pretty thing to do. And motherhood is not always pretty, but it's important to talk about. So one of the major things that motivated me to write the book, that it's so funny because like sometimes you just can't see these things until you sit down and have to write 300 pages about them. But when you're in the transition, it's really hard to know when it's over. And I remember there was one week at Glamour when there were three different times when three different people came into my office and said to me, I just want to say thank you for being so open about what is hard about being a new mom at work, because I also want you to know I still really respect you. I think you're so good at what you do, and I want to be like you one day. And I don't have kids yet, but you're helping me see that it's actually possible to be real and do a good job. And that, like, I'm getting like kind of emotional just thinking about it, because that meant so much to me. And even at different times in my career, when the industry that I was in was changing dramatically, the economy of it was changing, I really found that the parts of it that kept me motivated were not always the widgets that I was producing, but the people around me who I was giving an example to. And I think that it's important to remember that those are some of the things that can motivate you when you come back too.
And that's why now you're writing this book so that you can help tens of thousands of women instead of just the three in the office.
I hope.
So let's talk a second about dads, because I was very aware when I went back to work about the new dads. And I was really pleased to see that a lot of them really made fatherhood a part of their identity. And they were like, nope, leaving at 5 because I need to go home and, relieve my wife who's been with the kids all day or whatever. And I really like that. But I don't think they have kind of the same societal pressure on them that we do. And I don't know that they feel the need to make fatherhood part of their identity at work. Like, what do you think is going on between moms and dads? Like, do we hold new fathers to different standards?
I mean, it is definitely a huge societal problem. But in our own homes, I think we have a little bit of control over it. And it's really tough because this is the first generation of men, I think, who were really raised to believe that they should actively participate in home life and in raising their children. However, it's also the first generation of women who believe that we should be able to do absolutely everything. So, like, I was thinking about this before. I was asking my mom why I never heard her complaining about pumping when she was a new working mom, when she was telling me about when I was born. And she was like, well, because when I was at work, you got formula. I breastfed you in the morning at night. Because she just never felt the pressure to do that.
While
So,
smoking a cigarette and having a martini.
exactly. Not my mom, but a lot of moms. So, there is obviously in society, you know, even at companies that offer even parental leave for both moms and dads, the dads still take far less in general. And then obviously for the greater society, men take on average about 2 weeks of parental leave. My own husband took 3 days. He was in his medical residency. It totally sucked. And he regrets that. He wishes he could have been there.
Yeah.
But in general, the mothers take more time than the fathers do. And then so what that does is mom, who has been, you know, probably pretty high achieving and good at her job, wants to be the same way at home. And so she learns everything you're supposed to learn about taking care of a newborn baby. And then fast forward, however long your maternity leave is, whether it's a couple of weeks, a couple of months, 3 months, say you take FMLA, or you're able to, you go back and then you're both coming home at the end of the day. Only that whole second shift thing is really, really true, because you're the only one who knows how to do all these things that you learned how to do on maternity leave. So it's super, super important to let him help, but also to ask your partner to help. Ask your partner to take on whether it is just a handful of specific duties that can really be your partner's to like foster and love and enjoy. One woman I talked to described, she had twins, and she talked about how the bath was really hard for her. She just was always so scared of bathing the kids. And
I hated bathing my kids.
I did too.
I'm glad I'm not alone. I really didn't like it.
It was the same. Like, both of us hated pregnancy and hated bathing our children.
There we go. See, I told you, you are me, except you wrote a really great book and I didn't.
Oh my gosh, you're seeing you. So she talked about how she just turfed that duty right over to her husband, and her kids are now 4 years old and they still have what they call daddy bath every night. And so that's one small thing. You know, in an ideal world, you would ask for a lot more. I did talk to a couple of mental health experts who also described the idea of not just asking for logistically what you need, but really spelling out in words what it is you need emotionally. So there was one mom who was a patient of a therapist I talked to, who finally came to the conclusion that she just had to ask her partner every single day to tell her that she's a good mom, no matter what kind of day she'd had. Because if she heard it from him, she felt better. And he felt good for having kind of delivered on this duty for her.
Well, I will say that I did not get that kind of emotional support, which is why I ended up becoming a single mom. And I think there are a lot of single moms out there, you know, whether they started out single by choice or they ended up single through circumstances like both Kristen and me. So how is this different? I mean, it's one thing when you have a partner that you can rely on and tag team with. What about single moms? What can they do?
This is another thing that I really, really learned from my interviewing. I feel like every mention of your partner in the book is followed by a parenthesis that says, if you are fortunate enough to have one, and please take full advantage.
Or sometimes you're fortunate enough not to have one.
No, that's true.
I'll just leave that there.
You're totally, totally right. But I could write a love song. I could write a love opera to the single moms who I interviewed in this book, because they had far and away the most specific, solid advice. You know, this was not like kind of wishy-washy, like, oh, here's how I got to feeling better. It was, you got to hire a sitter if you can, or get someone to step in, whether it's your friend, whether it's an aunt, whoever, for 2 hours every Saturday, because you have to have that. It was just very specific, because they had no choice but to ask for help. And so, you know, whatever the guilt of that is, they hurdled that very quickly, because they realized that if they didn't take care of themselves, they were not going to be able to take care of this baby the way they
My muse was my best friend from childhood, who was a single mom by choice and found out after she became pregnant that she was having twins and absolutely flipped out. That was not the plan.
As I bet you that can imagine.
And she was like 34, so it wasn't like significantly later in life, but you know, we get to be called later in life moms once we hit, you know, the age old year of 35. So I always thought about her, and I used to think, okay, anytime I'm having a hard time or things are tough, I thought about her managing twins by herself and working full time. So I agree with you that like single moms are heroes in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. It's funny, I actually heard the same thing. So in the book, the deeper interviews, there's actually a disproportionate number of single moms, because they were also some of the first ones to raise their hands and say, I got stuff to share.
Huh.
And then also disproportionately, there are a number of moms, I don't know if you noticed this in my descriptions of people, but a number who have kids with special needs.
Yes.
And I think that was also because they realized very early on that they simply had to ask for what they needed.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that brings in a whole other set of circumstances that you have to manage when you're going back to work, especially when it comes to things like guilt and leaving the kids behind.
Absolutely.
So, you know, some of the things that you talk about in the book that are really great, you talk about like looking and feeling human again. And I'm really glad you did. And look, it even talks about like your guide to style, sanity, and big success after baby, right? That's your subhead.
Yeah.
But it's not a surfacey book. And this is one thing I really related to, is that the way you talk about style and looking human again overall, that actually has kind of a mental benefit as well. So what are your top tips for that?
It absolutely does. So I just have to start by saying the style and beauty chapters were the hardest for me to write. They were harder for me to write than...
What? You come out of Glamour magazine.
I know. Well,
they should be the easiest.
That's the irony. You know, I was never sample size. I was never borrowing stuff from the closet. And I was always the person who was trying to distill the information that all of the market editors, which are the people who were kind of getting the products and the clothes in, to make it palatable and wearable for kind of the typical reader, the typical American woman. But I was so flummoxed by the way my body had changed, by the way when I looked in the mirror, I just didn't look like myself or feel like myself. And I also on the inside just didn't want to prioritize it. It just didn't feel like, especially in the state of anxiety that I was having at that time, and I had postpartum anxiety, it didn't feel important. And yet, so I have an amazing little sister. Thank God for my little sister who saves me in kind of all of these moments. And she just like grabbed me by the hand and forced me to take 2 hours of my life to go buy some new clothes. And they were cheap clothes and they were black, but oh my God, did it help. It just helped so much. So I decided, you know, years later writing the book, I really wanted to look at the research about how looking good and feeling good about the way you look affects how you project yourself to the world. And like, lo and behold, it really is true. You know, there are studies about how lipstick affects your sense of self-confidence. Like, they exist and they weren't necessarily done by lipstick companies. There are studies about how your hair, you know, helps you feel good about yourself. And really, more than anything, I think it's just about feeling like you took the time to do one thing. I talk in the book about a concept called your generous minimum, which was really the thing that got me through. So it was the idea of whatever you think you can throw on, do one more thing. It's the opposite of that French rule of like, take one thing off. Like,
yes, the Coco Chanel rule, right?
Exactly.
Put on all your accessories and take one thing off. So you're saying put one more thing on.
Put one more thing on, or go one more extra step than you would. If all you would do is brush your hair, well, you know, put on some mascara too. One more thing that makes you feel like you, when you look in the mirror, like, oh, I did this for myself. I must be in an okay place.
I completely agree. And I've actually talked about this before on Spawn, that when I am sick and not feeling well, that's when I actually would go to work having nothing to do with kids, but that's when I would like wear heels, or that's when I would like look nicer.
Yeah.
Because if I went dressed for the college dorm, if I'm in like sweatpants and a big baggy shirt, it's like wearing a big sign that says I am sick today.
Yeah.
And I used to feel like if I put out there that I was looking good, I actually started feeling good too.
Yeah. It's true. It's funny. I had one woman I worked for who seemingly never, ever got sick. And then I realized, no, she just puts on makeup and she takes a lot of medicine. And I do think it's okay to get sick and to take time to be sick. But that it was definitely a lesson to me.
Yeah, like under eye concealer and, you know, Spanx and heels. It like helped me power through the day. And it sounds crazy. And maybe that doesn't work for everybody. But really, if I went in looking like I was feeling inside, I would end up feeling more like that.
Totally. And so actually, the women who I surveyed, I asked how much appearance mattered in their fields. And I was surprised at first because I asked, it was a scale of 0 to 10. How much does appearance matter in your field? And the average ranking was a 6, which I found interesting because I was like, oh, a 6, 60%.
That seems low to me.
It's low to me too, except when you think about it, if appearance didn't matter at all, it would be a 0. So actually 6 is really high. 6 is like, it's quite significant that you feel like you look good in order to do your job well.
I wonder what men would say, like men who are scientists or college professors, like how much does appearance matter in your work?
I would love to know that. I mean, -2, I don't know.
No, these days you just like, if you're a dude and you have rips in your jeans and you don't shave, it's like, oh, you're so trendy.
Totally.
We can't get away with that.
You hipster dad. One thing that actually, so women also talked about how they just had, you know, understandably, far less time in the morning to get ready. They actually spent more time in the morning awake before work getting ready, but the majority of that time was spent on the baby. And so they had something like, I think it was 18 fewer minutes to spend on themselves. So your shower becomes like, you know, a 32-second shower, and like you're not washing your hair as often, et cetera. So one specific tip that a stylist shared with me was to just make a mini closet within your closet, because that awful feeling.
My closet is a mini closet. I'd just like to say I live in Brooklyn. My closet doesn't accommodate many items to begin with. So I kind of have to start with a capsule.
They're all smushed together. Mine are just all smushed. But take the smush and take out literally, if it is six things that fit you that are appropriate for your job, put those in one side of your smush. And say that that is your mini closet. You are not even going to look at the rest. Don't waste your time in the morning sorting through and sifting through all that stuff. And don't waste the mental stress of like, oh gosh, when am I ever going to fit in these clothes? Is that even stylish anymore?
Oh, that's a great postpartum tip, because then you can look in your closet and say, 100% of my closet looks awesome on me.
Exactly. And it just eliminates that whole agita and stress, and you know, you start it's awful to start your day that way.
That's a great tip. And then you know, in addition to looking human again, which obviously helps you feel human, you have a lot of specific tips about feeling human again.
Yes, for sure. So you definitely need, and here's that term again, self-care. You definitely need a self-care plan at work. One of the big overarching findings of my surveying was that women reported that they were, I asked them when they were feeling physically back to normal after birth and when they were feeling emotionally back to normal after birth. The physical was about five and a half months. The emotional was 5.8 months, I think. So almost 6 months after giving birth did they feel emotionally like solid again.
Wow.
So for most women, they had been back on the job at that point for months, months and months. So you have to just kind of go in knowing that you're going to probably be back at work before you feel emotionally ready to be. So what can you do to prepare for that? First of all, you need a self-care plan. You need something that is going to be your go-to back pocket action plan for when you have a moment of extreme anger, extreme sadness, extreme ambivalence, whatever it is that is your go-to feeling, because we all have that.
And the answer is not vodka, right? Like you're talking about like a greater...
If only it could be vodka. no, it's not vodka. And it's actually not coffee either, although you can have some coffee. So what it is actually very different for each person. Some people describe it as a, you know, leaving the building, walking around the block if you're in a city, or around the parking lot if you're in the burbs, one time, you know, while eating five M&Ms. That was one woman's plan, I swear.
I love that.
One woman would take out the crossword puzzle and not put it down until she got three clues right. Somebody else used one of those, like, apparently quite best-selling coloring books, because they actually calmed her mind so instantly. But one way to figure out what self-care plan is going to work best for you is to take this thing online that's called the VIA survey. It's VIA survey. It's out of the University of Pennsylvania by a doctor named Martin Seligman, who is like one of the founders of the positive pop psychology. I'm getting the terminology wrong, but basically happiness psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you take a survey and it identifies what your leading character strength is. And there's like 28 of them, and they are everything from endurance to love of beauty to affection to discipline. And you could probably name yours right off the bat, like what is the thing.
Yeah, but I want to take the survey. I love surveys.
Well, in theory, I mean, like there's it's so good to take a quiz and a survey that actually confirms what you know. So it confirmed what I knew. I am a simple creature, and my number one via survey quality is love. I love feeling loved. I love giving love. It's my thing. So the question that I would ask myself to create a self-care plan is, what is the thing that makes me feel most quickly loved? And this may have made my husband a little sad to hear, but the truth is that every single time my dad hangs up the phone, whether it is a like, hey, what's the weather phone call, or a deeper conversation about God knows what, he always says, I love you, just without fail. I love you. So my self-care plan would be to call my dad, even if what I was saying to him on the phone was, Dad, I totally can't talk, but I'm just calling you because I'm having a bad day. Okay, gotta go. And he'd be like, okay, love you, sweetie. And that would be enough to know that I had taken that time to do that one thing for myself. Now, I'm really lucky to have my dad. That's not something that, you know,
But
everybody.
that's lovely. I mean, it's so nice to hear someone say calling your dad and saying, I love you is self-care as opposed to like go get a massage.
Exactly. I mean, who has, I still don't have time for a massage. I get maybe one a year and it is just, you know, I'm just reaching relaxation at the end.
My dad always said, if you're going to get a massage, you have to do 90 minutes because 60 minutes is never enough.
Right.
That was like his big massage wisdom for me.
Right. And I hope that wisdom came with a gift card.
Exactly. Like as long as you're paying for it, I'm in.
Exactly.
Well, listen, I just want to jump a little bit to institutional support for moms because there's a lot we can do for ourselves, but there's also a lot that's kind of stacked against us. And I think you saw the study that we just wrote about on Cool Mom Picks, where they just published a survey. It was Wallet Hub, and they wrote about the best and worst states for working moms in the country. And wow, like when I broke it down, it was really fascinating. And I'm a total data nerd. I know you kind of like research and stats too. So it's pretty amazing. But what they did was they looked at things like, you know, the ratio of female to male executives. They looked at, you know, potential for advancement, things like that. They looked for work-life balance, which had to do with things like childcare costs and length of commute and length of work week.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at pediatricians per capita, professional opportunities, pay gap. I mean, a whole lot of things. And it was fascinating. You know, I'm really pleased that New York came out just squeaked by number 9 in the top 10. So that's good for us. But then looking at the bottom 10, it was sad. Like I was sad reading it. And I saw that in Mississippi, 51% of working moms are below the poverty line, which to me is unconscionable.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of that comes from the lack of support that we give to working moms, and especially single moms, and especially struggling, you know, moms who are really just trying to support their family and do their best.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on institutional policies and things at the state, the federal level, local level that we can be doing to help support working moms to thrive and flourish and do their best?
So this book was born of exactly this problem. You know, there is virtually no federal support for new working parenthood at all. And it's just a shame. And it's not doing anything to help our country, you know, and I think that there are reasons for it. You know, we are still a fairly young country. When you compare us to that other list of those hundreds of other countries who have better parental leave policies than we do here in the United States.
All of them is the answer, by the way.
All of them. All 183 of them.
Has better policies than we
exactly.
do. Exactly. Yeah.
But I think that if you're trying to think of a reason, and I've always found in my work that understanding the context and the reason helps you kind of solve the problem. So I think that we are a young country. I think that we are still very much in the mode of the, you know, each generation needs to lap the next. We need to keep expanding. We need to keep growing. We need to keep moving up. And that's a feeling that I actually related to very early on in my career. I kept thinking if I just climbed the masthead at the magazine, I would get to a point where I had a lot of freedom once I had children. I know, right? Well, the industry didn't ultimately pay that out. But anyway, so I understand it. I dropped my son at school this morning and I was walking through Central Park and I was thinking about how Central Park didn't used to exist. Because when New York City was first growing and expanding, it was just this colossal, we're reading a lot of historical fiction in our family right now. And it was just this pile on of people living all on top of each other and, you know, mass growth all at once. They actually had to stop and create the green places.
Yeah.
And I know it was somewhat controversial, it was painful how those green places were created. But at some point, we had to stop and say, okay, hang on a second. Let's make some parks so that life is actually enjoyable. It's a simple comparison, but I think that the same thing is happening here. And I think that we need to stop on a federal level. I think that the Family Act, which has been proposed now for many years in a row, which would ask every American worker to contribute 0.2% of their paycheck to a fund to fund parental leave for both men and women for 12 weeks at, I think it's 2/3 pay, which is still not even quite enough, that it puts the onus on all of us. You know, being pregnant is the most visible personal life need you can have,
mm-hmm.
but there is no one you work with who doesn't have a personal life that they care about just as much as you care about your baby. So for women going back to work, I say it's really, really important to take into consideration everyone else's personal life. This is just some small thing that you can do. But as a greater country, we need to do the same thing. And we need to recognize that, you know, we are humans creating the next generation of humans. Whether you have a baby or not, you used to be one. And we all need to support that to some small degree because it will have massive effect on our next generation and on our country's productivity too.
Actually, I'm glad to hear you bring that up, because it's not just about respecting one another and personal choices. There is a tangible economic impact Absolutely. To women who can be more productive, take fewer sick days, have childcare they can rely on. And those babies, they grow up to be your neighbors and the kids that you're going to hire at your office one day. We are all interconnected. And I think we have to stop looking at ourselves as a nation of individuals and start looking at ourselves as a giant community of humans that need to support the weakest among us. And starting with working parents is an amazing place to start for a lot of reasons.
Hear, hear. Because who doesn't love helping babies? You know?
I think that's a great place to leave it. So listen, Lauren, where can our readers find you, and where can they find The Fifth Trimester, The Working Mom's Guide to Style, Sanity, and Big Success After Baby?
You can find the book anywhere books are sold. So you can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Barnes & Noble. You can find it at your independent bookseller. And you can actually look at indiebound.com, which gives you your nearest local independent bookseller, which I love using. And then online, my website is thefifthtrimester.com. And it has information about speaking and consulting, as well as about the book. And then on social media, I am at The Fifth Trimester on Instagram. On Twitter, I'm Lauren S. Brody. And on Facebook, I'm The Fifth Trimester as well.
And feel free to tag her on Twitter, Instagram, and ask her questions. If you guys have questions, Lauren is so amazing. And as she said, loving, and loves to give love and does it in the form of advice. So she can help you out. You can tag her at The Fifth Trimester on Instagram, at Lauren S. Brody on Twitter. You can find us at Cool Mom Picks, basically everywhere, one name, multiple social media, and you can use the hashtag Spawned Show so we can find you easily. And you can always drop us an email at spawned@coolmompics.com. We'd love to hear your perspective on getting back to work, and if you have any great tips to add too. So Lauren, you're going to stick around for Cool Picks of the Week, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Awesome. Well, we'll be back right after this. We are so happy to welcome our newest sponsor to SpawnedCare.com, especially because we've been fans of theirs for years. Seriously, if you go back to really early Cool Mom Picks posts, you will see us recommending them. They've always been an easy, reliable, awesome way to find care for everyone in your family, and really, they've just gotten better and bigger over the years. In fact, now you get access to 8.6 million caregivers across 16 countries so that you can find the local caregiver you need, a nanny, sitter, housekeeper, senior care, tutor, dog walker, cat feeder, basically you name it, it's there. In fact, it's Kristen's own number one source for childcare and for housekeepers. Every single one that she's found have come from care.com, and she and her kids have loved all of them, which is saying something with four kids. I like care.com, and especially the premium membership, when I'm traveling, because I just pop in the zip code where I am, and not only do I find tons of options for caregivers, but I can get tools like background checks, reference checks, qualifications, certifications, and getting started is super easy. Just sign up for free at care.com as a basic member, and you can post a job and start viewing in-depth caregiver profiles now. But we've got one better for you, Spawned listeners. You can save 30% off a care.com premium membership right now. Just visit care.com/coolmompics when you subscribe. That's care.com/coolmompics, P-I-C-K-S, and you'll get 30% off a premium membership. Totally worth it. So now it's time for
Cool Picks of the Week! Cool Picks of the Week!
So Lauren, do you want to start first? You're a guest, so I have to let you start first.
Sure. So this is way beyond the baby years, but my kids are now 5 and 8. And we discovered this awesome store in the East Village. It is about 50 square feet big. It's tiny. And it's called Tinkersphere. And they have a website as well, of course. It's really a store for grownups, but you can buy little tiny light bulbs. You can buy LEDs. You can buy power strips and wires and something called a Raspberry Pi that lets you create your own computer, your own working computer with internet.
Yes, we've written about that on Cool Mom Talk.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
So we just built one this week. And by we, I mean my father-in-law and my son. we built one this week. It's awesome. But so Tinkersphere is wonderful little family-run shop, and the people who work there are amazing, and its online presence is great too.
See, you are one of us. You're supporting an awesome small local business. That's great. And they're also at tinkersphere.com, so you don't have to be visiting the East Village to check out their cool web shop.
Exactly.
That's a great pick. So my pick of the week is, here's what we're going to see if you really are me. Are you a Princess Bride fan?
Oh my God, yes. I was just talking about it.
The best movie of all time. So much so, when I was single, I used to have a Princess Bride test. And any guy on a first date who didn't like the Princess Bride, that was the end of the date.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
So I love that movie so much. And it turns out this makes me feel old, but it's the Princess Bride's 30th anniversary.
Oh, my God.
Right? Oh, and so
coming I remember the
25th. Yes, yes. So this is the 30th. And so what they're doing is there's going to be a series of Princess Bride 30th anniversary screenings in theaters on October 15th and 18th. I think it's brought to you in part by TCM and I think Fandango. You can find information about it on Cool Mom Picks because we just wrote about it. You can also look it up on Fandango. But basically, you have to get pre-sale tickets now because this is going to sell out the same way that, you know, Sound of Music and Grease re-releases did. And I would love to take my kids to see Princess Bride in the theater.
No kidding.
That's my cool pick of the week. Go now and pre-order tickets because I want to do an inconceivable joke. It's inconceivable that you could miss it.
I'll tell you something inconceivable. What's inconceivable is that TCM's branding and marketing department, which probably fueled that whole project, is run by this woman who's awesome, whose name is Jennifer Dorian, who's interviewed in my book.
Yay! So it all comes together. And I bet she loves The Princess Bride, too.
I bet she does,
everyone
too.
In your book must be a cool mom.
She's wonderful.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for joining us for an episode of Spawned.
Thank you. This was so delightful. I really appreciate it.
It was so great to have you. And hey, huge thanks to our engineer, John Bowen, and we love hearing from you. So please leave us a review on iTunes. Make sure to subscribe. In fact, do it right now. And be sure to download our episodes so you don't miss one. You can even listen to it for a little me time on your commute. Thanks so much for listening to Spawned. This is Liz. Kristen will be back with us next week, and have a great day.